The bell master is coming. Right of Pháp Dung. His name is Pháp Dung. I think Dung means inclusiveness. Inclusiveness. Let us sit beautifully like a Buddha. Buddha is described as sitting on a lotus flower. It means that when he sits, he feels light, peaceful, and beautiful. The human body can be very beautiful if you allow our body to relax. It's a real flower. So let us learn to sit relaxingly like a Buddha. We sit on a lotus flower and not on a heap of burning charcoal. Myself as a flower. Breathing out, I feel fresh. Flower, fresh. Breathing in, I see myself as a mountain. Breathing out, I feel solid. Mountain, solid. Breathing in, I see myself as still water. Breathing out, I reflect things as they truly are. Water, reflecting. Breathing in, I see myself as space. Breathing out, I feel free. Space, freedom. Good morning, my dear friends. Today is August the 22nd in the year 2011. We are on our fourth day of the retreat with the theme Body and Mind Awan. I trust that the young people, the children, are having a good time in the retreat. Plenty of time to play. Please don't think that the monks and nuns do not play. They play a lot. Even Sister Chen Kong, who gave us sessions of total relaxation, she plays a lot. In Plum Village, the nuns play soccer with the children. And the monks also play soccer with the children. When you play, you want to be happy. Otherwise, what is the use of playing? So to play means to have a good time, to feel happy. But sometimes we are not happy when we play. We get angry. That's not a good way to play. When you do sport, you play. You play such a way that both parties can be happy. The winning party is happy, but the losing party is also happy. That is the best way of playing. And the nuns in Plum Village know how to do it. They play soccer with the children. And they always lose. And they don't suffer at all when they lose. In fact, the children are very happy, and seeing the children happy, the nuns are happy also. So losing is a kind of winning. And if we don't know how to do that, we may like to riot after a game and suffer and make other people suffer. The Buddha speaks about victory, winning. And he said that this is a kind of victory that make both people happy. And we should learn how to get that kind of victory. In this victory, not only one side is happy, but the other side also happy. When someone is angry, when someone says something very mean to you, so when someone hit you, he's losing because he doesn't have happiness. And if you get angry at him and you try to say something mean to him or to her, you are losing also. So both of you are losing. And the Buddha said when someone is not kind to you, and if you know how not to be angry, you still have compassion in you, you are the winner. And when you win like that, you will not retaliate, you do not punish him. So your victory is good for you and good for the other person also. And in the teaching of Buddha, we learn how to breathe mindfully, to understand that the other person is not happy, that is why he is violent. She is violent, she is mean. And when we see like that, we don't suffer. In fact, we want to help him or to help her not to suffer. And if we allow compassion to be born in ourselves, we win. But that victory is not only for ourselves. That is for the other person. You win for both. That's the expression the Buddha was using when he talked about how to deal with anger. If you allow compassion to manifest, if you know how to not let the anger overwhelm you, if you know how to smile and to love, to be compassionate to the other person, you are the real winner. And you do not only win for you, but for the other person also. So next time when you play, learn to play in such a way that both the winner and the loser do not suffer. This is the highest way of playing. I think the monks and the nuns in Plum Village, they have learned that. Maybe in this retreat you can organize a soccer game with the monks and the nuns. Why not? Today we learn the third mantra. We have learned the first and the second one, and now is the time to learn the third one. It's about love. The first one, remember, darling, I am here for you. I offer you my pleasant, beautiful, refreshing presence. Second mantra, darling, I know you are there, fresh, loving, alive, and that makes me very happy. The third mantra you use when you know that the other person suffers. And this, with this mantra, you go deeper in the practice of love. Because love can be very deep. Love can get deeper and deeper. And the deeper your love is, the happier a person you become. Your happiness is in function of your love. As your love grows, your happiness also grows. That is why I have to learn from the Buddha how to allow our love to grow and to get deeper. You love someone not only because she is lovable, only because she is lovable, because he is lovable. That is love, of course, but that's not deep enough. You can go deeper. Even if the other person is not lovable enough, you can still love him or her. That is the love of the Buddha. And we also have Buddhahood in us, and we can learn to love like that. When you see someone suffer, and you have the intention to do something in order to help him or her to suffer less, that's true love. That's compassion. And that is why when you see the other person suffers, you go to him or to her, you breathe in and out in order to be fully present, and you pronounce the third mantra, darling, I know you suffer. That's why I'm here for you. You offer your presence in order for her to suffer less, for him to suffer less. And by doing so, you deepen your love. Your love has the capacity to help the other person to suffer less. So remember, memorize this third mantra and practice. Because around us, there are those who suffer, many of them. And they need our love. We have to see that they suffer. And when we see they suffer, we see them suffer, we don't want to punish them anymore. We do not hate them anymore. We are not angry at them anymore. We don't suffer. And yet, we have the intention to do something, to say something, to help him or her to suffer less. This is a very beautiful kind of love. Remember, not only you love him or her because they are lovable, but you love him or her because they suffer. They need you. And there is a way of loving that is very deep, very wonderful. That is the kind of love without discrimination. You do not discriminate them, even if they don't follow the same religion, if they are not the same race, if they are not the same belong the same nation, and so on. You love because they suffer and they need your love. That's all. You don't discriminate. And the highest kind of love is non-discrimination. If our society suffers because there is a lot of discrimination, and if we know how to love without discrimination, and then we can remove suffering, we can make people happy. There is a kind of wisdom called the wisdom of non-discrimination. This morning we hear that let us chant as one body, listen as one body, and transcend the frontiers of a delusive self, transcending the complex of superiority, the complex of inferiority, and the complex of equality. Some people don't understand what does it mean, the complex of equality. In my right hand, when I look into my hand, I see my hand has the wisdom of non-discrimination. It never discriminates against my left hand. My right hand does not say something like, "Left hand, I'm better than you." never my right hand says a thing like that. And yet my right hand does a lot of work. She can all the poems I wrote were written by my right hand, except one. That day I did not have a pencil. So there was a typewriter somewhere, and I put an old envelope into the typewriter and both hands typed together. My right hand practiced calligraphy, inviting the bell, do many things, does many things. But my right hand is not proud of herself and look down on my left hand. She is free from the complex of superiority. And you know something, my left hand does have also the wisdom of non-discrimination. She does not suffer. She does not have the complex of inferiority. She does not suffer because she does not have the complex of inferiority. One day, my left hand was holding a nail. And my right hand was holding a hammer. They were trying together to hang a picture. But that day, my right hand was not very skillful. Instead of pounding on the nail, she pounded on the left hand. These are things that happen from time to time. You don't want it, but it happens. So right away, my right hand put down the hammer and took very good care of my left hand. Exactly like she takes care of herself. And she does not say, my left hand, remember, I am helping you. Remember, someday you will have to help me back. Because my right hand has the wisdom of no self. My left hand also has the wisdom of no self. There are two hands, but there is no discrimination. They do not even consider themselves to be equal. When you compare a self with another self, you can say that one is superior, one is inferior, or one is equal. But if you don't have a self, you don't compare. And that's why the third complex is not there also. The complex of equality. I am as good as him. That is also a complex. You don't feel that. There are three complexes. High self-esteem, low self-esteem is not good. But high self-esteem is not good either. And equal self-esteem is not good either. There's no self. My left hand suffer, but my right hand understand the suffering. And she took good care of my left hand. My left hand did not get angry at all. This is true. My left hand did not get angry at my right hand. Because she has the wisdom of no self, no discrimination. She didn't say something like this, right hand, you have done injustice to me. I want justice. Give me that hammer. My left hand did not say something like that. She didn't behave like that. She did not get angry because she has the wisdom of non-discrimination, of non-self. That is why my right hand and my left hand always get together perfectly in peace and harmony. And as brothers and sisters in one family, as members of the human family, we should learn how to be with each other like that, and then peace will be possible. And Buddhist meditation is to help you to look deeply in order to get the insight, the wisdom. And you can remove all discrimination. There will be no more war, separation, anger, and violence. And today, please learn more about this. This is very important. When you hear the small bell, please stand up and bow to the Sangha before you go out. And remember, come back at 11 to do walking meditation with us. Have a good day. If your beloved one is not aware of that, they suffer more. Because to love is to be aware. To have the mindfulness, the awareness that you are there. And you suffer, and she does not know that. He does not know that. But if the other person came and practiced the third mantra, you suffer less right away. That person came with his or her true presence and pronounced the mantra, "Darling, I know you suffer. That's why I'm here for you." Before you do something to help him or her suffer less, she suffer less already. So that is the effect of the third mantra. To recognize, to be aware of the suffering that the other person has in himself or herself. The fourth mantra is a little bit more difficult for the children. But we have to learn because we may need it. And that is to be used when you suffer and when you think that your suffering has come from the person you love the most. If it was another person who has said that to you, who had done it to you, you would have suffered less. But this is not another person. It is him or her, the person you love the most, that has said that to you, that has done it to you, that is why you suffer very deeply. And the tendency is to punish him or her because she has dared to make you suffer. And this is a very kind of, very subtle kind of punishment. You don't say anything, you don't reproach, you don't shout. But you still want to punish him or her for having made you suffer. So you try to prove to him or to her that you don't need him or her. You can very well survive by yourself alone. There is a kind of amour propre, pride in yourself. So you prefer to go to your room and lock the door and cry alone. You don't want to ask for help. And it means that you want to punish him or her. You want to say indirectly that alone you can survive very well. That's human. But it brings suffering. That is why we need to do meditation and to practice the third or the fourth mantra. The fourth mantra is to go to the other person and say, "Darling, I suffer. Please help." Very simple. But if you cannot say it because you have pride in you, anger is too big, you don't want to ask for help. And you are kind of betray the initial commitment that you should share with him or her not only happiness but also suffering. Now you suffer and you have to share that. You have to tell him or her that you suffer so that he or she can share and can help. You want to punish You want to prove that you can survive alone. That is why when he comes and asks you what is wrong, and you say, nothing is wrong. He asks whether you suffer. You say, why do I have to suffer? Pride. And if the other person tries to come and touch you, you say, leave me alone. You want to punish. You want to show that you can survive alone very well. You don't need him or her. That's anger. So the practice we offer to our friends who come to Plum Village is the mantra. And there are three sentences you can write down on a small piece of paper, the size of a credit card. The first sentence is, darling, I suffer. You have to be frank, to be honest. If you suffer, you say, you suffer. Darling, I suffer. And you can add something like, I suffer, I want you to know it. I don't understand why you have said such a thing to me, you have done such a thing to me. Please explain. But the essential is to say that you suffer. Darling, I suffer. And the second sentence is, I'm doing my best. Because I am a practitioner, I don't do like other people when they get angry. I don't shout. I don't say something. I don't do something when I get angry. That is my practice. Because I understand that if I say something or I do something when I am angry, that may create suffering to myself and to the other person. That is why I don't do anything. In fact, I go back to myself and practice mindful breathing to take good care of my anger. I use the energy of mindfulness to recognize my anger and embrace tenderly like a mother holding her baby. I am trying to look deeply into the nature of my anger. It may be a misconception, a wrong perception. It means I am doing my best as a practitioner. And the second sentence can be very short. I am doing my best. And the third is crucial. Please help me. And if we can bring ourselves to write down these three sentences, we suffer less right away. If we cannot tell him or her directly, and then we can write it down and give it to him, maybe in the form of email. But our friends would keep that piece of paper and slip it into a wallet. And every time she needs to practice the fourth mantra, she gets angry, she suffers, and she believes that her suffering has come from the other person. You take it out and look. And she would know exactly what to do and what not to do. when the other person read this first sentence, he will or she will ask himself the question, what I have said, what have I done to make him, to make her suffer like that? So the other person will do some kind of reflection, meditation. And when reading the second sentence, I am doing my best, the other person will be proud of you because you are not like other people. You are a practitioner. You do not say or do anything when you are angry. You have gone, come back to yourself and practice mindful breathing, mindful walking, and taking care of your anger. So the other person, he, she will be proud of you. And that is an indirect invitation for him or for her to practice like you. It's very beautiful. Both of you are practicing. And then the third sentence, please help. After having written down or sent this message, you suffer less, and you continue to practice, looking deeply into the nature of your anger. And if you find out that your anger has come for a wrong perception, maybe the other person did not have the intention to make you suffer, but you believe that he or she had the intention to make you suffer. So the practice of looking deeply might help us to recognize the wrong perception that is at the foundation of our anger, and we are free. And when we are free, we should write another message, send the other a message that you have overcome your anger, that you have found that your anger was based on the wrong perception. Usually the practice is when anger manifests as a mental formation, a practitioner would go back to her breath and breathe mindfully and recognize it as anger, call it by its true name, and begin to look deeply and to calm it down. That is the eighth exercise of mindful breathing. The seventh is to recognize anger. And the eighth is to embrace and to get a relief. But if 24 hours are about to pass and your anger is still there, and then you have to practice the fourth mantra. The principle is that not to keep your suffering for yourself alone more than 24 hours. That is not good for yourself. You have to practice the fourth mantra. Send him, send her a message. If you cannot go to the other person and say directly because you don't believe that you are calm enough to say it, and then you write it down on a piece of paper and send it to her or to him. And that will help you suffer less. And you continue your practice. There is a story that happened in the 15th century in Vietnam, and every Vietnamese knows that is the story of Mr. Trung and his young wife. He was drafted into the army when his wife was pregnant. And fortunately, he was released from the army after 3 years. And his wife, Lady Nam Sung, together with the little boy, came to the gate of the village to welcome him home. So they cry in each other's arms. This is a happy reunion after 3 years of military service. And that is the first time the young man, the young father, saw his son. So according to the tradition, the lady has to go to the marketplace and buy something to prepare an offering to be placed on the altar of the ancestors. That is the tradition. In every home, there must be an ancestral altar, even if you are very poor. You still have a little table and an incense burner. And every morning you light a stick of incense and offer to your ancestors. That is a kind of practice that helps keep you connected with your ancestors. And the practice is that anything important happened to your family, you have to announce to your ancestors. They have the right to know what is going on. So when you are about to send your little boy to school, and you have to announce that, you have to offer a fruit or a flower and announce to your ancestors that tomorrow you send him to school. If you marry your daughter, you have to announce to your ancestors. So the lady has to prepare a real offering and announce the return of the young father. And while she was away shopping, he tried to persuade the little boy to call him daddy. But the little boy refused. He said, "Mister, you are not my daddy. My daddy is someone else. He used to come every night. And my mother talked a lot with him and cried a lot. And every time my mother sit down, he sit down. Whenever my mother lie down, he lie down also." So the young man, the young father suspected that there was someone intruding into his household. So he lost all his happiness. And from that moment on, he did not say anything anymore. When the lady came home very happily preparing the offering, he did not look at her anymore. He did not answer her question anymore. He was completely different. So both of them suffered very deeply because of a perception. They believed that someone has intruded into the family. And yet the reality that is that no one has intruded into the family. The fact is that one day the little boy went home from the hamlet and said, "Everyone, every boy, every girl has a father. Why don't I have one?" And it is too difficult for her to talk about peace and war and army and military service. So she pointed her own on her own shadow projected by the kerosene lamp on the wall and said, "This is your father. Why don't you just say hello, daddy?" So he believed, the little boy believed that the shadow of her of his mother is his father. And in fact, she talked to her own shadow. She was so lonely. She said things like, "Darling, my good husband, you have been away for too long. How could I alone be able to raise our child?" And she cried. And of course, when she sit down, the shadow sit down. That's the truth. But there was a wrong perception on the part of the young father. He suffered very deeply. his heart became a block of ice. So he did not look at her anymore. He did not answer her questions anymore. He believed that she has committed the crime of adultery. And when the offering has been placed on the altar, he lighted incense and prayed. And instead of sitting down and share a meal of family reunion, he left and tried to forget his suffering by drinking alcohol. And he did not come back until 3 a.m. And he continued like that several days in a row. And the lady could not bear it anymore. She threw herself into a river and got drowned. And that night when he learned of that, he came home and he took care of the little boy. And when he lighted the lamp, suddenly the little boy said, "Mister, this is my daddy." He used to come every night like this, and he pointed to the shadow of his father on the wall. Now, there's no longer any wrong perception, but it's too late. It's a true story. The villagers of the, when they learned about the tragedy, they came and organized the funeral. And they built a shrine, and the shrine is still there. Emperor Lê Thánh Tông, one day passing by, he asked, "What is the use of the shrine?" And the people in the village told him the story. He was so moved, and he wrote a poem about the story of Nam Sương lady, Mr. Trương. If they knew the fourth mantra, they would have been able to avoid the tragedy. The lady should have gone to him and say, "My good husband, I suffer. Please tell me why, from the moment when I am back from the marketplace, you did not look at me anymore. You do not talk to me anymore. Have I committed a crime in order to be treated like that? Please help." That is the fourth mantra. She did not practice that. She suffered, and the pride in her prevented her to ask for help. If she had practiced the fourth mantra, he would have told her what the little boy has said, and the truth will be manifest. But the young father did not do it either. He should have gone to her and say, "Darling, I suffer. I suffer so much." The little boy said that during my absence, someone used to come every night. "Why have you done such a thing to me?" If he has gone to her and asked for help, she would have had the chance to explain, and they would have, both of them, avoided the tragedy to happen. That is why we should not do like Mr. Trương or Lady Nam Sương. Next time, when we suffer, and if we believe that our suffering has come from him or from her, the person we love the most, do not allow pride to stand on the way. Practice the fourth mantra. And this is recommended by the Buddha. It is possible to sign a love treaty, a peace treaty with our partner on these matters, that when we suffer and if we suspect that our suffering has come from the other person, we will practice like that. It's very important. We have learned that the 11th exercise on mindful breathing is to concentrate the mind, and the 12th is to liberate the mind. Liberate, to liberate means to liberate from something. That may be anger, despair, and so on. So the 11th is concentrating. The mind, and the 12 is to liberate the mind. From the afflictions that are at the foundation of our ill being. In the teaching of the Buddha, there are many forms of concentration, samadhi. And we can select one or two in order to practice. In the Sutra of Mindful Breathing, there are the four concentrations are proposed. But there are dozens of concentrations. And there are three concentrations that you can find in every school of Buddhism. That is the concentration on emptiness, on signlessness, and on aimlessness. They are described as the three doors of liberation, the three concentrations. Emptiness is not a philosophy or description of reality. It's rather a tool, an instrument for meditation. Signlessness. And aimlessness. Shunyata, emptiness. Animitta, signlessness. And apranihita, aimlessness. The three doors of liberation. In the sutra of mindful breathing, four methods are proposed. First, it is meditation on impermanence. The second is non-craving. Third is cessation. And fourth is letting go. But there are many dozens of concentrations that we can learn and select from. Impermanence is a concentration. We know that everything is impermanent intellectually. We know that we cannot take a bath twice in the same river. We know that things change all the time. But that is intellectually only. We see that we are impermanent, our beloved one is also impermanent, everything is changing, and yet we still behave as we are permanent and she is permanent. That is why impermanence is not a doctrine, an idea, but an instrument, a concentration. You have to keep it alive, the insight of impermanence. Suppose you get angry at your beloved one. You suffer. You want to say something, to do something to punish him or to punish her because she has dared to make you suffer. And at that time, you need to practice concentration. And you may choose impermanence as a method. You close your eyes. You breathe in. And you visualize yourself 300 years from now. And your beloved one 300 years from now. It needs only 3 or 4 seconds during your in-breath to visualize your beloved one 300 years from now. And you touch the reality of impermanence. And you wake up, you see that she's still alive, he's still alive in front of me. And your anger disappears right away. And the only thing you want to do when you open your eyes is to take her into your arms. Darling, you are still alive. I'm so happy. So impermanence is not a theory, a notion, but a concentration. We need the concentration of impermanence than a theory. Non-craving. We crave for this and for that because we don't know the nature of the object of our craving. Happiness is made of understanding and love, and not objects of craving like power, fame, sex, and wealth. And many people suffer very deeply and destroy their body and mind running after these objects of craving. When the fisherman used a bait in order to catch a fish, he knows that a fish will be attracted to the bait. If the fish knows that there is a hook inside of the bait, he would not bite. So it's very important to look into the nature of the obstacle of craving. There is a hook inside. And that is a concentration. The other object is very attractive, appealing, but because you have the insight into the true nature of that object, that you are, that is why you are still free. You are not caught by it. And cessation here means to remove all the notions, including the notion of being and non-being, beginning and ending, above and below. There is a Buddhist teaching on symmetry. If there is above, there is always below. And the above and the below appear at the same time, one basing on the other. And right view is the kind of wisdom that transcends both notions. We are sitting here doing sitting meditation, and we believe that this direction is our above, and this one is our below. But the people who are sitting on the other side of the planet, they don't agree with us. Our above is their below, and they think that we are sitting upside down. So the notion of above and below cannot be applied to the cosmos, to reality. The same is true with the notion of being and non-being, birth and death. And cessation here means to look deeply in order to remove all these notions that can create fear and despair. It's a very deep meditation called the middle way, transcending all opposites. When Antoine Lavoisier declared that nothing is born, nothing died, he came very close. That is about the law of the conservation of energy. Let us imagine, let us draw a line representing time. Going from left to right, from the past to the future, and pick up one point and call it B, representing the birth of something, our own birth. Everyone of us has a birth certificate. And we believe that we begin to exist only from that moment. Before that, we did not exist. So the segment ending with B represent non-being. And the segment beginning from B on is called being. And to be born means from non-being, you pass into being. That is our way of thinking. To be born means from no one, we become someone. That's our way of thinking. From non-being, from the realm of non-being, you come to the realm of being. And interestingly enough, science is still caught in that notion. Scientists are trying hard to answer the question, how the cosmos has come into being? How from non-being the cosmos has come into being? That is why there is theories like Big Bang and so on. We have observed already a cloud. We know that before she expressed herself in the form of a cloud, she had been something else. She has not come from the realm of non-being. It's impossible for something to come into being from non-being. A cloud is a continuation of something, like the water in the ocean, the heat. She has not come from non-being. Her nature is the nature of no birth. There is no sacred, nothing is born. And birth is only a notion. It cannot be applied to reality. Cessation is the removal of the notion of birth. And then when we come to 100 years later, or less, to a point we call death, D. Well, the segment B, D, represent our lifespan. Remember, the Diamond Sutra suggests that we remove the notion of a lifespan. The Diamond Sutra, a text that is very cherished in the Zen tradition. And we believe to die means from being, from the realm of being, we pass again into the realm of non-being. And that is our notion of death. Death is from something, you suddenly become nothing. From someone, you become no one. And that is the reason for our grief, our despair. As for our cloud, although she is no longer there, visible in the sky, but she has not passed into the realm of non-being. She has become rain and tea. She has become snow. And she can be seen in the rice field, in the wheat field. She continues always. It's impossible for a cloud to die. She can become rain or snow or hail, but she can never become nothing. So death is just a notion. The notion of death cannot be applied to reality, the ultimate reality. And the language of science can help in her way of expression in order to help us understand this. So if your beloved one is no longer in her usual form that you used to recognize, that does not mean she has passed from the realm of being into non-being. She continues always. Look at her karma, her action. Nothing is left, is lost. The energy is always conserved. And if the eyes of a practitioner, you can recognize her continuation, his continuation in other forms. And not to be caught in an appearance free from sign is signlessness. You don't cry when you don't see your beloved cloud anymore, because you know that your cloud is always there in other forms. Because to be a cloud floating is beautiful, but to be rain falling is also very beautiful. And as you recognize your cloud in her new form, the rain, you don't cry anymore. You are free. And that is the practice of a concentration called signlessness. You are not caught in the appearances, in the form. So cessation here means cessation of notions, the notion of being and non-being. Of birth and death. The nature of the cloud is the nature of no birth and no death. The nature of your beloved one is also the nature of no birth and no death. Your own nature, our own nature, is the nature of no birth and no death. Birth and death cannot affect us. We are free from birth and death. So our fear, our despair has no ground. I think the scientists can look deeply and can describe reality in a different way, but it's like Lavoisier. Nothing is born, nothing dies. And if we know that the notion of birth, the notion of being and non-being cannot be applied to reality either, you save a lot of time. Not only philosophers, but also scientists. According to the insight, right view, being and non-being are just notions. To be or not to be, that is not the question. The monk who asked the Buddha what does it mean, right view? His name is Katyayana. Katyayana, Mahakatyayana. He said, "Dear teacher, you often speak about right view. What do you mean by right view?" And the Buddha said, "Right view is the kind of view that is free from the notion of being and non-being." Not only God transcends being and non-being, but also cosmos and everything else. Quantum physics are coming way closer and closer. And we can imagine the scientists holding hands with practitioner of meditation to get the insight that will help us to reduce fear, discrimination, anger, despair, separation. They can work together, the scientist and the practitioner of spirituality. Next year, in the month of June, we will have a 21-day retreat. The title is The Sciences of the Buddha. You organize the retreat for scientists and Buddhist practitioners to come and to do sitting meditation together and Dharma sharing together. We will share the insights of both traditions and to see how Buddhism can support science and science can support Buddhism. In Buddhism, we speak of two kinds of truths. The first one is relative truth, samvritti, satya, conventional truth. There is birth and death, inside, outside, cause and effect, wholesome, unwholesome. And that truth is helpful also. If you know how to handle, to make good use of that truth with no prejudices, and that truth can help you transform and liberate and get a relief. But there is another kind of truth, not conventional. It's called ultimate truth, absolute truth, where there is no birth, no death, no being, no non-being, no coming, no going, no sameness, no otherness. And that is the true nature of reality. And if you can touch that true nature of reality called nirvana, you are free from all fear and despair. And in the Buddhist tradition, we make good use of both kind of truth, whether it is a conventional or ultimate truth. And there is a continuation between conventional truth and the ultimate truth. Samvritti and paramartha. Paramartha is ultimate. In science, it seems there are two kinds of truth also. Classical science, represented by Newton, tell us that material objects, they have their individual existence in time and space. But in modern physics, in quantum physics, the view is completely different. Things are not outside each other, things are inside each other. And what we call empty space does not exist. Space and matter, force and mass, they are not different things. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And the nature of the particle is very close to the nature of no birth, no death, no coming, no going. The nature is non-local. It's very, very interesting. Scientists are trying to see the connection between the two kinds of truth. And it would be very, very interesting to exchange our insight and to inspire each other on the path of looking. In Buddhist circle, we don't need very sophisticated instruments, expensive. We need only to to make use, good use of our mind. Our mind is overloaded with fear, anger, craving. And if we can purify our mind, it will become the best instrument for science. And scientists can profit from that practice to discover more and better. So please come to our retreat. The Science of the Buddha from June the 1st to June the 21st. There is the notion of coming and going. Cho thầy mượn cái hộp quẹt. This is about non-locality, the non-local nature of reality. It has to do with space and time. Suppose you talk to the little flame that is still hiding in the box. When I strike a match, it looks like I bring the flame from the realm of non-being into being. And when the flame is gone, it passes again into the realm of non-being. That's our way of looking. But with this meditation, we know that our flame, our little flame, it is free from the notion of being and non-being, and birth and death. If we would prefer to use the expression manifestation rather than birth. Dear little flame, I know you are always there. You only need to manifest because your nature is free from being and non-being, birth and death. So why don't you manifest yourself for us? And we know that the flame has not manifested because she's still waiting for some conditions. And when conditions are sufficient, she will manifest herself. We can talk to her because to say that she belongs to the realm of non-being is wrong. Although she has not manifested. Dear little flame, I know you are there, inside of the box and outside. We know that oxygen is very crucial for your manifestation. So that is also available. So why don't you manifest for us? And the flame say that, dear Thay, everything is ready. Except one last condition, I need a movement from your fingers. And we provide the flame with that last condition so that she can manifest. I know, my dear little flame, you have not come from the realm of non-being. And later on, you will not go back to non-being because your nature is free from the notion of being and non-being. Your nature is like the nature of a cloud, nature of no birth and no death. My dear little flame, you are hiding yourself. Please tell us, where have you come from? And if we listen with concentration, we will hear this, dear Thayde Sangha, I have come from nowhere. I have not come from the south, not from the north, not from the east, not from the west. My nature is non-local. When conditions are sufficient, I manifest. I have not come from anywhere else. My nature is no coming. You are in love with someone. You have the tendency to look into his eyes and I say, darling, where have you come from? You are so wonderful. You are a wonderful manifestation. Tell me, darling, where have you come from? And she may like she may answer you the same way with the flame, darling. I have come from nowhere. My nature is the nature of no coming. When conditions are sufficient, I manifest. It means that you have to make sure that conditions are always sufficient, otherwise I will stop my manifestation. And when he asked, my darling, where have you gone? And you got the same answer. Dear Thay, dear Sangha, I have gone nowhere. I have not gone to Mexico or Africa or Asia. When conditions are no longer sufficient, I just stop manifestation. My nature is no going. And we know that she has told the truth. Everything belongs to reality, has that nature. The true nature of reality is the nature of no coming, no going. And if we can touch that nature, we are no longer victims of grief and despair. The insight has the power to liberate. I believe the scientists, when they hear that teaching, they will be inspired. When they look deeply into elementary particle and the behavior of these particles, they find something very similar. Their nature is nature of no coming, no going. Someone said, in the realm of science, said that the quantum, they don't really exist. They fluctuate in and out of existence. They don't really exist. They have only a tendency to exist. The talking of science is like that today. The other couple is sameness. And otherness. So all these notions have to be removed in order for reality to reveal itself. My dear little flame, are you the same flame with the other flame that manifested earlier, or are you a different one? That is a koan. It looks like two flames. Are they two or one? And that question we can address this flame is, my dear little flame, are you the same with the other flame, or are you a totally different one? And if we listen very carefully, we will hear that I am not exactly the same with the other flame. But I am not a totally different flame either. My nature is free from sameness and otherness. And that is the middle way, the insight that can liberate from our fear and our despair. When we look into the album, we may see ourselves as a baby. Our mother had taken our picture when we were a toddler. We ask the question as we ask this, the same person with that toddler or another person. We have changed so much form, perceptions, feelings, mental formation, consciousness, which have changed so much in 20, 30, 50 years. And yet we cannot say that we are exactly another person. So the truth is, we are not the same, but we are not a totally different person. That is the middle way, transcending both the notion sameness and otherness. So when a father looks into the person of his son, he may ask the question as whether his son is a totally another person or he is the same with him, with the father. We know that a mother cell can divide herself into two daughter cells. And the daughter cell is another cell, the same cell. So the answer is neither the same nor a different one. That is the nature of reality. So if the son saw that he is a continuation of his father, that he see that his father is still alive, is still fully present in every cell of his body. He don't see that he is a totally different person from his father. His father lives on in him, and he can also see him in his father. He sees the nature of interbeing between father and son. He sees the nature of no sameness, no otherness. And that insight helps him to be free from any discrimination, any separation, any anger. So the insight of no sameness, no awareness, also has the power to liberate. And that is also a concentration. Let us talk about the four notions that the Diamond Sutra advises us to remove. The Diamond Sutra is very well-known sutra in the Zen tradition. The diamond that cut through all delusion. And the first notion is the notion of self. Myself, yourself, himself, herself, themselves, their selves. And the meditation on no self get insight, give us insight that liberate us from discrimination and fear and complexes of superiority, inferiority, and even quality, equality. Looking into what we call a self, we find out that a self is made only of non-self elements. A flower, we know that, is made only of non-flower elements. A flower does not have the power of self-existing. Without non-flower elements, it's impossible for a flower to manifest. The Buddha is made only of non-Buddha elements. Dear Buddha, before I bow to you, I see that you are empty of a self. And I myself, I am empty of a self. It means I see myself in you and you are in me. Therefore, our communication is deep. A Buddha is made only of non-Buddha elements. A lotus is made only of non-lotus elements, including the mud. And Buddhism is made only of non-Buddhist elements. That's what I learned when I was a novice. The Dharma is made only of non-Dharma elements. And that is the way of looking into a so-called self. You see that a self is made only of non-self elements, and you are free. As a Buddhist, you are free from Buddhism. And fanaticism is no longer possible. The second notion the Diamond Sutra advises us to remove is the notion of man, human. Because when we look into man, we see that man is made only of non-man elements. Man, in fact, is a very young species on Earth. We are made of non-man elements, including animal, vegetal, minerals. And we still have all of them inside of us. We are their continuation. And that is why, in order to protect man, you have to protect non-man elements, including animals, vegetables and minerals, the environment. And that is why the Diamond Sutra is maybe the oldest text on deep ecology. In order to preserve man, you have to learn how to preserve non-man elements, including the minerals, the animals, and the vegetables. And that is the second notion that we should try to remove. Man is impossible without non-man elements. And the third is living beings. We distinguish between living beings and inanimate dead matter. And we think that living beings are intelligent, and the matter is not intelligent. But we have found out that matters are very intelligent also. This plant has a lot of wisdom. She knows how to make beautiful leaves and flowers. There is knowledge, there is consciousness in her. A seed of corn. You can see the plant of corn inside. And the seed of corn knows how to make ears of corn. The discrimination between matter and living life should be removed. And then the discrimination between you and the Buddha, you are as a living being. And Buddha is a fully enlightened one. You know that the Buddha is made only of non-Buddha element. Without you, a Buddha is not possible. That is why there is no complex between you and the Buddha. The Buddha doesn't have a complex of superiority, and you do not have a complex of inferiority. And that is why the Lotus Sutra says that everyone is a Buddha. To me, the Buddha nature is in us. And the central message of the Lotus Sutra is the inherent nature, Buddha nature, is there in you. With mindfulness, concentration, and insight, you are a Buddha. And these things can be manifested from within. So there is no complex that you, the Buddha, is the object of my worship. No. So the third notion is the notion of living beings should be removed. Discrimination between living matter and dead matter. Discrimination between man and the Buddha. And the last one is lifespan. We believe that we begin by point B, and you end point D. Before B, this non-being, and after D, non-being. And you exist only from B and D. That notion of lifespan should be removed. And the notion of birth and death do not scare us anymore, because we are no longer caught in the notion of birth and death and being and non-being. In Buddhism, there is no We do not speak about, we not use the word God. But we use the word Nirvana. Nirvana means the extinction of all notions, including the notion of birth and death, being and non-being, reality as it is. And Nirvana is not situated in time and space, a place where we have to go. Nirvana is the nature, the true nature of reality. It is the nature of birth, no birth, no death, no coming, no going, no sameness, no otherness. And with the practice of deep looking, meditation, we can touch our true nature of no birth and no death, no being and non-being, and become utterly free from fear and anger. With other kind of practice, we can get a relief and suffer less. But the greatest relief we get only when we are able to touch our true nature, the nature of Nirvana, the nature of no birth and no death. But Nirvana is not something other than us. Nirvana is our true nature. It's like the wave coming up and going down on the surface of the ocean. She doesn't have to go and look for water. She is water in the here and the now. So Nirvana represents our ultimate reality. And we are always there in that reality. And meditation means to have the time to look and to touch our true nature. And Zen Buddhism speak about enlightenment, about the practice of realizing our true nature, the nature of no birth and no death, available in the here and now. We continue tomorrow, after tomorrow. Now it's time for us to enjoy walking with the children.